You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We are this morning waking the women. We are delighted to welcome Jane Manfredi, Anglican deacon, writer, BBC Radio 4 contributor, to talk to us this morning in conversation with Becky Hall, trustee for Greenbelt and recent author of a book, The Art of Not Enough. The Art of Enough. How to thrive without striving. As women, our bodies change throughout our lives, and it can feel like a heck of a striving. It can feel like we're not understood. There are misconceptions, there are myths, and the church quite often hasn't got a clue. We are delighted to welcome you both to help us to see our way through and how we can thrive without the striving for all of us together. Thank you, Jane Manfredi and Becky Hall.
Thank you so much, Jo, and welcome everybody to this fabulous conversation. Isn't it refreshing that we can talk about the menopause? Yes. Well, I can certainly say, as a menopausal woman, Jane, thank you for writing this book. That's what I want to say first of all. And we're going to be in conversation for most of the session. We might have time for some questions at the end. Jane's going to be signing books and things later, so you can catch her, because this is, I know lots of you will have lots of things that you might want to say. But first of all, Jane, can you tell us about your book? What made you want to write about the menopause, and especially the menopause in the context of faith?
I was just thinking about the title, actually, Waking the Women, and you're all about as awake and of an audience as I've ever spoken in front of, actually, so thank you for that, firstly. So the idea for it came a few years ago now, actually. So when I was in my final year of training at Theology College, and I was around age 42 at the time, so not quite at that point where I was going into menopause, but becoming aware of it, because as I think everyone is now aware, this is a real hot topic, if you pardon the pun. And there had been an absolute massive explosion of talk about menopause in popular culture. There was podcasts about it. It was all over my social media feeds. People were writing books about it. Davina McCall was talking about it and written her book. And I thought, why is the church not talking about it? So we had to do, in that final year of study, we had to do an assignment on for pastoral theology, an assignment on one part of the life cycle. So you could do it on death or aging or childhood, teenage years. And I thought, well, you know, I'm middle-aged now, so I'll do it on middle age. And that was when I discovered that there was next to nothing at this point about middle age and about menopause. And I thought, well, that's a bit odd, because most of the people in our churches, you know, the biggest demographic by far in the church across denominations is women. And it's women over a certain age. And I thought, well, that's really odd that we're not, there's no research on this. So I did a bit of digging, and I found a paper given by Reverend Julie Gittos, which I think you can find online. And that was, she had reimagined the story of the bleeding woman, which I believe you've just had at was the reading at today's Eucharist. So she had reimagined that story as one being about menopause, because that's precisely what happens. We have this woman who is in need of healing. She's been bleeding for 12 years, we're told. And she goes to Jesus and she touches Jesus' cloak and the bleeding stops. Well, that's menses pausing. That's menopause. So Oh, before I continue, can we just have a small note on language, actually? So I tend to use menopause when I really mean perimenopause. So, because I find perimenopause is so clunky, but I tend to use them both kind of interchangeably, and I don't want to use in-speak and assume everyone knows what we're talking about. So just very briefly, perimenopause is the word that is used to describe the period, again, pardon the pun, going up to the time that your periods will stop. So that would be the time when you would experience the symptoms that we'll talk about, that you would associate with feeling menopausal. Menopause is actually just one day. It's the day, but officially, 12 months after your last period. And then after that, it's happy menopause day, and then you are postmenopausal. But I tend to use menopausal to mean the whole thing, just because, as I said, I find perimenopausal kind of clunky. So anyway, Reverend Julie used this story to think about menopause and what this means. What does this mean through a lens of faith? And it was such a good paper, and that was kind of it, really. I think there was a similar article that I found by Elaine Storkey using the same passage, and that really was it. There was nothing else. So I thought, wow, this doesn't seem right at all. So I took to social media, and I said to my network, other Christian women, I said, does anyone want to talk about this? Does anyone feel like we as a church ought to be talking about menopause? And I was absolutely inundated with people contacting me saying, I really want to talk about this, and I've really been suffering with this, and I haven't been able to talk to anybody about it. And so we had a Zoom conversation. I think it might have still been a bit COVID-y at that time, but we had a really great discussion. And then after that, I set about sort of thinking about it more in terms of research and thinking about getting a book proposal together. It kind of grew out selfishly, really. It was the book that I wanted to read myself for what I was going to be going through. and that's where it came from.
Yeah, I love the concept of Happy Menopause Day. Happy Menopause Day.
Everybody. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Mine's been and gone. So in lots of ways, it reads a bit like a series of feminist sermons, which I really like. It's got that sort of vibe to it. And you seem to create sort of three categories that you talk about: the physical, and then the transitionary side of it, and then societal. So we'll ask you some questions about each of those three things. But the first, the physical, you gloriously and very comedically sometimes talk about the physical symptoms of menopause, and it speaks to your idea that in the church especially, but in society too, we don't often talk about our bodies and perhaps the messy part of our bodies. So for example, you talk about the menopause symptoms in all their messiness, from hot flushes, brain fog, dry vaginas, and red hot rage. Now, just before we move on to the question there, we had a conversation yesterday about how many times you'd, and in what places you have used the term dry vaginas. Can you tell us about that?
Dry vagina. So I've got ticked off green belt now, actually. But no, the first time I said it in a church was in Manchester Cathedral. Just over a year ago, I'd been invited there by Grace Thomas, who's a friend and is one of the canons there. And she said, I think it's the first time that anyone's mentioned vagina in this space, let alone dry vaginas. And after that, I've managed to tick off a few more churches where I've done talks and numerous podcasts and radio. So, yeah, right. I mean, I sometimes forget that not everybody is as comfortable as I am with talking about these things. And one of the things that surprised me and distressed me, actually, when I started having conversations with women, gathering research together, was how growing up in the church had really messed up some women's attitudes to their bodies. They'd grown up especially women who'd grown up in more of a conservative setting, it had made them quite repressed about talking about their bodies, that things like periods and hot flushes and all those sorts of things weren't polite, weren't nice, were gross, weren't to be discussed, had to be hidden away, had to pretend that these things weren't happening. And that's not been my experience at all, and for two reasons possibly. Firstly, I didn't grow up in the church. I had a very godless upbringing, but the main reason, I think, is because of my mother. So my mother was a gynecology nurse, and is also the most embarrassing woman who ever lived. And I love her dearly, but yes, as a teenager with my mother, actually she still embarrasses me. So this payback. she's just very, very open with anything to do with bodies. A story that I recount in the book, when I started my periods when I was 11, she just announced it at the dinner table to my dad and my brother. And my dad is a very, very quiet, taciturn, at the time, he's older now, but tattooed, muscly, manly man, my dad. Not a man in touch with his, actually doesn't have a feminine side, I don't think. and she says, "Oh, by the way, Jane started her periods." And my dad, who's like picking up the bottle of Big Daddy's brown sauce or whatever, just says, "Oh, okay." Put it back down, and that was kind of it. You know, there was no... I've always been really open about talking about these things, and the things that you're really not supposed to talk about, like clots and all that sort of stuff, like that just... I've never been fazed. So I started these kind of conversations and then encountered women who were like, we don't say that. I'm really not used to talking about this, but I'm suffering really badly, and I need to talk about this, and I need a space. So my mission was, I want the church to talk about this. So not to go into, you know, sit from shout out vagina in the middle of a service, you know, just to make it, you know, just to make it more more inclusive, and for us to get over our squeamishness, but to mean that there'd be less shame. I really wanted women to not feel ashamed of their bodies anymore. Mm. Because if we can't come to the church to be healed, we can't bring our full selves to be healed, then there is no real healing for us. So that was one of my my goal, not to be just egregiously offensive.
No. Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned when you started your periods, because you talk in the book about this sort of cycle that women go through from menage. Is it, was that the word?
I think it's menage, but menage. I pronounce things wrong all the time. So
when you start your periods and menopause, and you describe ways in which what happens to some women when they're younger, when they start their periods, it can feel profoundly limiting, and the menopause can actually help us become whole again. I love that sort of almost a parenthesis that you put around the time of our lives as women who bleed, when we start and when we stop. Can you say a bit more about that?
So I felt very, I felt very strongly about this. And as feedback that I've had from women who've read the book, the most common piece of feedback I get is about that, the chapter where I talk about this. So the story of the bleeding woman is like a sandwich passage with a healing story. Well, Jesus raises a girl from the dead. So he heals the bleeding woman, her bleeding stops, and then he goes straight from there to Jairus's daughter, and Jairus's daughter is dead or is dying, depending on which gospel passage you read. And Jesus goes and he tells her to rise up, you be alive. Mm. And the juxtaposition of those two passages, the girl is 12 years old, the woman's been bleeding for 12 years. And I just thought, I wonder if we're supposed to see that connection between the two, and that maybe there is something that happens when the bleeding stops that returns us to, not to a child, but to some of the bodily freedom that I had when I was younger before the bleeding started. So like a lot of women, I had really ghastly periods when I was younger. Really not dissimilar to the bleeding woman, although I suspect that her story is possibly something more serious, like endometriosis or something like that. We obviously don't know. But I definitely have very, very heavy bleeding, which was debilitating and was just awful. And a lot of women can identify with that. And this was in the days, it was early 90s, and it was before all ways were invented, and you'd wings and dry weave top sheets and all that. So the only thing that you could have were these, you remember those giant thick pads? Yeah. You still get them now they give them to you in maternity wards, don't they, after you've had a baby, and they're like sausages. Like they're useless. And I remember just filling my underwear with these things and having to go to school, and you have to wear a school skirt and you're not allowed to go to the toilet, and then you bleed on your skirt and then everyone sees it. And when I started talking to the women about these things, they were like, that happened to me too. And I'm like, yeah, it happened to my daughters. It happened to my daughter's friends. It's still happening. This is... You see, I feel very passionately about this. Mm. I mean, thank heavens for Always and the wings, because that was a real innovation, that was, wasn't it? Yeah.
We were saying, weren't we, about Wimbledon, it's only been the last 2 years that the female players have been allowed to wear black pants under their white skirts.
In 2025.
That's mad, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, because there's no way I would, when I was younger, definitely, I wouldn't have done it. So I felt very... my hope is that menopause means more bodily freedom. Mm. that's my hope, that it will, when the bleeding stops, that all that we return in some way to the girl that we were, the girl that we were before we grew breasts, and then they started. You can't go anywhere without being conked out from cars down the road, and all those things that happen to you as you go through puberty. I hoped that there was kind of like a reversal almost of that. I saw it as menopause. I started to see menopause as something that might be really hopeful. Mm. Yeah.
Lovely. And now might be a good time to talk about Red Hot Rage, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got a chapter on anger, in all seriousness, and of course anyone who's menopausal may have experienced these sort of flashes of anger that do come physiologically. But you also talk about it in the context of courage and in the context of how it can be energising and releasing. So can you tell us about anger and what you think about that in relation to menopause?
I think after hot flushes, anger was the symptom, the perimenopause symptom that women recounted to me the most often. That was the second most common thing that women told me. They were just like, I am so pissed off. Like, really, I am just so, I don't know why, but I just feel just really angry all the time for seemingly no reason. And this rage just bubbles up. And I think some of it is perhaps hormonal. Anyone who suffers with PMT, that's been the blight of my life and my husband's life. those awful, you hate everyone and you're so angry. And a lot of women are going through that during perimenopause. But I think some of it is repressed anger, I think. Mm-hmm. I think some of it is from having been told from being very young that you're a girl, so you need to smile when you're told to smile, and you need to be prioritize being nice over being truthful, and you need to prioritize fitting in over being genuine, and all these things that girls are socialized into. I think that can be very unhelpful for us psychologically. And I think you get to a point where you have just, you're just fresh out of dams. and I think that's definitely part of midlife. And you grow chops, I think. You yeah. suddenly sort of say, no, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah, there's that lovely, there's an Instagram woman I follow who's menopausal, and she talks, she's got a whole handle called the I Don't Care Club. And look it up if you're looking after it. She's fabulous. That's woman from South America. She's fabulous. The South of America. So let's talk then about ageism. And I think you had something to say about foreheads, Jane.
Oh, my gosh. So so I did a talk during Lent at a local church, and I think I called it I have bad feelings about my forehead, which was riffing off Nora Ephron's book I feel bad about my neck, as you age, these things that happen. But my particular paranoia is my forehead. Like, right, mine has lines on it, and I can't. I really struggle to see I was struggling to see on my social media, on TV, women my age that had lines on their forehead. Like, what's happening to everybody? What? that can be that. Not seeing realistic examples of aging is really, really hard. And I know it's everyone's choice to do what they want to do, and I know that, and I'm not please don't think I'm knocking anyone for who chooses to do that. I mean, we all do what we have to do to feel better, don't we? But it is hard. It's hard when it's also an economic point, isn't it? Not everyone can afford to have these things done. I've had a lot of surgery on my face from birth and childhood, through not anything to do with aging, because I was born with a cleft lip. So I've had enough of needles and injections and stuff in my face. I don't want to. I wouldn't ever choose to have any more. But yeah, it can be discombobulating when you're looking in the mirror and you're thinking, well, I've got creases and wrinkles, and nobody else that I seems to, and these people in my phone are all smooth and perfect, and it can be challenging.
Yeah, and there's also something, isn't there, about the age and stage of women in their, between their mid-40s to their mid-50s, after that can happen in public life, especially where people feel invisible or less prioritised or less important, which fits into that narrative, doesn't it? The idea that because you're older, you're therefore less relevant.
Yeah, and the whole way that we talk about men and women at those ages is different as well. So in the book, I think when I was writing it, Kate Moss had just turned 50. And the way that she was talked about turning 50, and I quote an article where it talks about her, they're talking about her turning 50 like she's the last rhino in Africa. You know, it's just ludicrous. It's like she'll wake up tomorrow and she'll be 50. Like, oh no, you know, this terrible thing's going to happen to her. So just as an experiment, I Googled Daniel Craig turning 50. And the whole tone was just completely different. It was, he looks so fit now he's 50, you know. And after I've written the book, I noticed that the same thing happened with the Beckhams. So when Victoria turned 50, it was all, oh, how do you feel about aging, Victoria? And then for David, it was, let's take a picture of you in your pants, David. You know, it's all, doesn't he look so great still? That's really irritating and not...
Yes, preach. Are you going to read a bit?
Oh, yeah, I'll read a bit, actually.
Is it page 30?
No.
I think it would be lovely to hear from some of your book, because it's so funny and accessible, as you can imagine.
Which bit am I reading, Becky? Because it's not page 30. Did you want me to read the bit on ageing?
Yes.
Ah, yeah. Okay, here we go. Okay. The church is obsessed with courting and sustaining the attention of youth because the young are seen as the only viable way for the church to grow and achieve new life. So you'll barely even register as being significant to the statistics if you're over 40. I've lost count of the number of times someone in the church has referred to the over 40s with a snidey, pejorative edge to it, a tone that immediately makes me reimagine myself as being as torpid and decrepit as Charlie Bucket's grandma's. A bit mouldy and irrelevant. Nothing useful to contribute, faintly embarrassing, taking up space in the middle of everything with my giant iron bedstead. The disconnect is confusing. Inside, I'm still young and vital. I'm integral to the storyline. But some sections of the church make me feel as if I ought to take to my room, don a frilly mop cap like Mrs. Bennet, screaming shrilly about my nerves while everyone downstairs rolls their eyes and argues about who has to bring me my tea. To add credence to the disparaging stereotype, whenever a famous over 40s woman appears in public not resembling a toothless, sexless old hag, the astonishment that abounds is very telling. She's 50, the tabloids and social media exclaim in shock, as if she's performed a miraculous trick. And she has all her own teeth and isn't even using a hearing trumpet. It's amazing. We marvel at how the celebrities with their glamorous top-end lifestyles all seem to coincidentally also be genetically advantaged when it comes to aging, which is why when I'm giving myself my morning pep talk in the mirror, I always make sure to say, remember, you're not fat and old, Jane. You're just skint.
Lovely. Shall we talk a bit about the societal context a bit more? What can we do, especially perhaps in church spaces or in any of our spaces really, that would make our spaces and our ability to talk about ourselves as more inclusive to all women and girls?
So one of the things that I've talked about before is, and one of the things that I think is actually happening is there's more research happening about this. There are more people writing about it. There's more people talking about it. In academia as well, which is not, my book is not an, I don't know whether you noticed, but it's not an academic book. So that's happening. That's really, really good. Eventually, I hope that we would, it would be lovely to have hymns which honour women's experiences. It would be lovely to have more liturgies to honour it. But it would be also good to dig down into the specifics of it. So my book's only 40,000 words long. It's written by me, and my when I say it was written on a shoestring, it wasn't even written on a shoestring. It was, nobody's getting rich from Christian publishing, trust me. And it was hard to write it. I wrote it in the wake of having a very, very serious mental breakdown. I was recovering from that. This was my healing. But it was hard to just get access to, as someone who's not an academic, I didn't have access to online academic journals or anything like that. So it was really hard to carry out any sort of in-depth field research or anything like that, just as one person on my own. So I did the best that I could with the people who approached me and kindly talked to me and who responded to my call-outs on social media. But yeah, it would be brilliant to have more in-depth look at the Black experience of menopause, because that's potentially very, very different from what I've written. I do reference some of that, but there's only, I did try and be as general and as across it as possible. I think the trans experience of menopause as well, and the non-binary experience of it. I think the disabled experience of it. There was one woman who talked to me and said that she had a long-term condition, and she said, I've got to the point now where I don't know whether it's my condition that's worsening or whether it's perimenopause. So there was that confusion over the symptoms. It presents differently in different types of people. So it would be really great for people to drill down into that and look at it across the board. And that all that body talk can only be good, I think, for the church generally.
So really it's about creating spaces where it's okay for each and every one of us to talk about our experience of what's going on in our bodies as well as our hearts and our minds and our spirits.
Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you. One of the things I really loved about your book was when you started to talk about menopause as a transition that holds both grief and freedom. You describe it as an invitation to sit with the paradoxical pain of Holy Saturday, which is, you know, where grief is a necessary precursor for joy, and any transition, I guess, holds both of those things. You talked about, you quoted Saint Dolly of Parton saying, "Sorrow shares a border with joy."
No, she said that. She says, "Oh gosh, brain fog. What does she say?" It's from Steel Magnolias, which is my absolute favourite film. Mm-hmm. I love it. I am Weezer, by the way. That's the character I identify with the most. She's like grouchy, mm-hmm. miserable. That's me. But yeah, Dolly Parton, she says, tears through joy is my, or tears through laughter is my favourite emotion.
Lovely.
And it's mine. It's mine too. Yeah.
Mine too. And we know that love and grief walk hand in hand, don't they? I mean, you can't have one without the other, really. But can you say a bit more about the transition of menopause and how menopause can actually help us grow in wisdom? Because it's such a hopeful thought.
I mean, it's hopeful. I'm waiting for my for my wisdom.
Oh, no, it doesn't necessarily come when you're menopausal, believe me.
Oh no, you're supposed to tell me that.
So
one of the joys of the work that I've done, and surprises actually. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, because as already stated, the majority of people in churches are over a certain age, and a lot of them, I was surprised at how many elderly women came along to the talks, some in their 80s, and that surprised and thrilled me, actually. Mm. And they were saying things like, this was never talked about in my day, and isn't it wonderful that we're able to talk about this? And I all sorts of stories, some of them really quite heartbreaking, women who had gone through it as this silent passage where you weren't able to talk about it. It was the change, it was something shameful, something that happens to your mum that you don't want to, no one can talk about it, and we'll have to whisper about it and pretend it's not happening. That was their experience. And then there's my mum's generation, which is one down from that, where they had gone sort of the cold turkey frontiers women route of no HRT, because in the 90s HRT was demonized and they were all told that it was going to give them breast cancer, so they didn't dare take it. So it's been really, really lovely to have access to and to share conversations with those older women who've been through that journey already and are out the other side. And some of the stories are so, so hopeful. The one that thrilled me the most was this might have been in a conversation about dry vaginas, actually, where she said that her sex drive had gone through the roof after menopause. And I thought, well, that's something to look forward to, you know. So there's a whole range of experiences. That's the other thing to bear in mind. Older women as a resource for younger women. And I see that my generation are that too. And I see that the stories we tell and the stories we share is like leaving little breadcrumbs, little nuggets of hope for younger generations to follow. And I think the church is unique in that it's a great multi-generational space to be able to do that.
Lovely, I really agree with that. So in lots of ways, it's a book about a sort of cry for recognition, isn't it? And especially at that sort of menopausal stage, and about how women can be more visible, how can be recognized, can talk about their experiences. And especially within the church, with no shame. And there's a lovely passage I would love you to read, the passage on page 92, and then perhaps talk about where it came from.
So this is from the last chapter, which is called Making Sense of the Middle. And it's the chapters are split up into symptoms. So the most common symptoms and the ones that were most commonly reported to me, because obviously if you go online, there is about 8 million symptoms that could be attributed to perimenopause. So I focused on the main ones that appeared most often. And this chapter deals with depression, which isn't a given that you're going to go through that during perimenopause. I pray that most of us don't. But some women definitely reported that to me. This chapter was born out of one conversation in particular I had with a woman who had had premature ovarian failure. So she had gone into perimenopause before you would normally expect to. And that can be quite vicious, as can surgical menopause. So people who've had their ovaries removed, you obviously are plunged into menopause overnight. And usually often when you're younger than you would normally go through it naturally. And that can be really vicious. And the woman that I spoke to was having a really, really hard time. And that really stuck with me. And I thought, I really want to honor that. And I want to honor her story. That's what this chapter's about. So, most women, when asked what they want the church to do to accommodate or support them in their menopause, don't actually want the church to do anything at all. They just want to be able to have the freedom to name what's happening to them without feeling embarrassed or ashamed. They want to be held like the church, held by the church, like Jesus held the hand of the woman with fever, or have a place to speak the whole truth like the bleeding woman did. Most women just want to feel like they're not suffering alone. There's a lesson here for how absolute love is modeled by partaking of someone's misery just by sitting beside them. Holy Saturday is God's demonstration to us that there is no place he won't go to be beside his children through their suffering. Like Naomi, God has also traveled to the regions of God-forsakenness. And for the depressed and traumatized, this is a thought that gives comfort when little else does.
Lovely. Thank you. I thought that was really wonderful. Yeah. You sort of segment up your book with chapters, as you say, about the different symptoms, but then you've got these sections on the wilderness. You take us on a journey, really, as though it reads to me as though they were a fictional journey in the wilderness of a group of women, some young, some old, who go on a journey. And there are little passages, they're really poetic and beautiful. Can you tell us a bit about that and why you wrote those in?
So my first love is creative fiction, and that's what I hope to write next, actually. That's my first love. So that is something that's woven through the book. I think it probably what makes it an unusual book about theology and faith, because you don't usually get that that creative strand running through it. For me, it was born out of a podcast that I heard from Barbara Brown Taylor. A lot of you nodding because she's awesome, isn't she? And it was from the Evolving Faith Conference. And she talks about something that she calls subsistence theology. So it's a theology. She talks about it so beautifully. Go and listen to it if you can. It's on Spotify. It's called Evolving Faith. She talks about this idea of times when you have to fall back on diminished resources. So those times in your life where you are at the absolute end of yourself. So you might have been made redundant, you've gone through a breakup, you've had a terminal diagnosis, something bad has happened to you, and you suddenly you're struggling and you find yourself in a metaphorical wilderness, a place where you nothing looks familiar. You don't recognize where you are anymore. All familiar landmarks have gone. Everything has changed. What do you do in those circumstances? And I thought, oh gosh, maybe menopause is such a wilderness. Maybe it is one of those times where you have to just dig down with what you've got with you. You can't take what you've always used with you. You can't take the same tired old props that you've always used, because this is different. Everything's changed, and you have to just somehow survive. And how are you going to do that? And we know that wildernesses are places, we know, thanks to Jesus, that wildernesses are places of growth and of flourishing, even though they feel pretty darn scary when you are in them. So that was when I had the idea of, I want this to be a journey through the wilderness. And that's what happens. So there is a story that flows through it of women of all ages who take off on this journey into the wilderness, and they take off together. And it's about the lessons that they learn during that journey. And I think they're lessons that can be, that can change us in profound ways. Mm. And sometimes it might be really, really scary. You might, you know, have to wrestle with angels and fight with demons. But you will come out of the other side changed. And hopefully for the better.
I really loved the way that in those sections you had young women helping the elder women sometimes, and the elder women passing down wisdom to the younger women. It was a really lovely sort of balance.
Yeah, I think, I talk a bit in the book about how I feel like modern culture or pop culture seeks to divide women so much. It seeks to... we grow up being quite, this is definitely my experience, being taught that you need to compete with one another, and that you're somehow pitted against one another. And I think that can be quite vicious. In like the story about Kate Moss turning 50, it was the way that they'd written it. I think it was a young woman who'd written it as well. It was about how she must feel envious of her beautiful young daughter, because looking at her daughter would remind her of all that she'd lost. So it's that horrible trope of the evil stepmother, this idea that older women envy younger women because they have youth and beauty and we've lost it, and we're these shriveled hags that. And I am more likely to feel mumsy to you if you're younger than me. I don't envy being, I wouldn't, oh, girls, I wouldn't swap with you. I wouldn't. But I think that these are the ways that culture seeks to divide us. Mm. And that's profoundly sinful, because we need to stick together. You know, we can learn so much from one another. Mm. And that needs to be a feature of... a feature of what happens to us, I think. Mm. That idea of us sticking together and being a resource for one another. Yeah.
Thank you. Perhaps now you can share with us the working title that you had for your book, if you can't remember it, if I've written it down.
No, I can't remember it. I only wrote the thing. I can't remember.
you said in the book, your working title from the book while you were writing it was Midlife and Older Women Are Bloody Amazing and Should Be Celebrated. I think you should have kept that one.
Anyway, I should have. But it became... it wasn't my genuine working title, but no. Yeah, I do think that you are bloody amazing. You are, especially, you're all amazing, but especially in the church, it is if women of a certain age downed tools tomorrow, the church would cease to function. It would cease to function. You know, it is women who are. It's women who are preaching, who are leading PCC meetings, who are making the teas and coffees, leading the toddler groups, doing the flowers, greeting people at the door, teaching and leading and you're amazing. And we need to honour that and shout about that because it's really, really important.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And just in the spirit of inclusion for all the men in the room, I also applaud you, because being in a room talking about the menopause is it would be really wonderful if this room was full of men talking about it. So thank you for the men and non-binary and trans people who are also here. Jane, before we stop for maybe a few questions, could you read us the end bit of your book? Because it was so, it's a really sort of a rallying cry, and we've had quite a lot of that. But you have a really prayerful vision, don't you, for what we could be? And I thought it would be lovely to hear you read it, if that's okay.
Okay. I pray that my words serve you well. I pray you feel comforted. I pray you feel less alone. I pray you feel proud of who you are and of who you've been. I pray you feel excited about who you're becoming. I pray you never lose hope. I pray you never stop seeking God with all your heart and all your mind. And I pray you find purpose and wonder in the meaning of midlife. This is our awakening. This is our time. Let's grab those tambourines and get busy waking up the church.
Lovely, thank you. Thank you so much, Jane. It's just been such fun reading your book and talking to you about it. And we've got a bit of time for questions.
Thank you, Jane. As someone who's followed you in the past on Twitter, can I be permitted to go off topic and ask you, who is your favourite character from the Bible and what would their favourite biscuit be?
It'd be so twee to say Jesus, wouldn't it? I'm not going to do that. I think Hagar. Hagar is the one that is, I have her words tattooed on my wrist, Elroy, where she, we know this, but hopefully most of us know the story. If you don't, she's Sarah's maid, and she's beaten, and she's sent, she runs away into the wilderness, actually. And when she's there, she has an encounter with God, and she is the first person to name God. And she says, "You are Elroy, the one who sees me." And that has helped me and comforted me during like the hardest times. Like, no matter what happens, God sees me. God sees what's happening to you, the bad, the ugly, when nobody else does. And that's important to remember. What did you ask me what their favourite biscuit would be? With Hagar, I think she'd probably be like one of those Choco, I can't pronounce it, is it Choco Leibniz? Choco Leibniz? She'd be into fancy biscuits, I think. And she deserves, a really top tier biscuit.
Great question. Thank you. There was a question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for the brilliant conversation. Just in practical terms, what would you like to see? How can we do this? I mean, in terms of actually introducing it more into church or just ideas for where we go with this. Thank you.
Thank you. I think some of the things that's already happening. So one of the talks that I did was at a church in Wandsworth Common with the fabulous Rev Tiff, who's sadly not here today. She was here yesterday. One of the things that she did after she'd taken my book on retreat in January, and then when she loved it so much, it spoke to her so much, she came back and she organised a women's event where we talked about bodies and we talked about menopause. So that's definitely something that can happen. Other people have started book groups with it, Bible studies. I think it's simple things, isn't it? Like having the courage to talk about these things in intercessory prayer. Like, when did you ever hear that in the church? Like, I hope it's just about being courageous, I think, and not feeling ashamed. So it's small steps. And my book is really, I mean, like I keep saying, it is very small. And it is just, I see it as like, it's just one seed thrown onto a garden of stories, which I hope other people will tell theirs. And they'll be very different, but it will grow. And hopefully through that, we will just get more comfortable talking about these things.
Thank you for the talk. My name's Mary.
Hi.
As someone who's been living with that vicious experience of premature ovarian failure and doing so at the same time as having small kids, I would really love to hear any advice from the both of you on that question of the how do you do a bit more thriving and a bit less striving in these life stages?
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. That's really, really tough. And I, yeah. it's bad enough when you're doing it raising teenagers. I don't know which is worse, actually, raising. So you're so exhausted, aren't you, when you're raising your very young children. But then when you're raising teenagers, you've got their hormones to contend with as well as your own. it's really hard, isn't it? And I think one of the things that's been brilliant about the conversation happening globally, at least in the West, is that women are developing more confidence to go to their GPs. There's definitely more understanding of HRT. You know, it's not HRT, is it? There's different names for it, but hormone replacement therapy, or just hormone therapy. I know that a lot of women have taken that and have found it to be, a real godsend. And then I guess, just to keep talking, with your friends, ask them, if, I don't know whether you are a Christian or not, I'm assuming you are, ask, don't be afraid to ask for prayer for these things. Sometimes people want to help but don't know how. just keep talking, I guess, and get all the medical help that you feel you need. Thank you for that question.
Yeah, thank you. And for me, in terms of thriving, I think, especially when you're going through as challenging times as you clearly are, but in any event, I think there are things that we can all do about really focusing on what resources you and how can you find micro moments in each day to resource you, whether that be just a calm cup of tea or a walk in the woods or sitting under a tree. So there's something about being really intentional about resources and giving yourself permission to be exactly as you are. And if that is exhausted and wrung out, and so that's how you are today, and permission for that to be okay, it seems really important, because I think we put so much pressure on ourselves to be amazing, when actually sometimes just doing a day is enough. So that's what I would say.
You need to read your book.
Hi, I'm Kaylee. I was just wondering, as someone who had to scrape together considerable pennies to go to a women's health consultant to get my adenomyosis diagnosis, that's not easy to say, what do we do to get medical professionals to take us seriously and not just go, well, you're bleeding, of course it hurts?
I'm sorry that you've been through that. That's not an uncommon story either, and that's definitely part of the overall picture, isn't it, of women's pain historically and currently being dismissed. So many stories of women being fobbed off by GPs, being told that have some Prozac instead of a friend of mine was actually put on Prozac, and then in the end she was given vaginal estrogen, and that sorted her, but she'd been told that she wasn't allowed it, and then there's the cases of women who spend decades trying to get an endometriosis diagnosis, which is why the story of the bleeding woman is so relatable, isn't it? Because we can all relate with this poor woman who has had to, she's spent all her money on doctors and still didn't get any healing. I'm obviously not a medical professional, but I'm definitely of the opinion that the more that we highlight this, the better hopefully it will be. And I think perhaps your experience isn't a good example of that, but perhaps my hope is that it is better than it once was. I think that there's definitely moves there's campaigning going on to from Parliament and stuff to get it more recognised and honoured and easier for women to get access to the help that they need. But I'm so sorry that you had to it's disgusting, isn't it? It's not right. Yeah.
Hi. There's something I've been thinking about a lot during this weekend at Greenbelt and also last year, and keep wondering about it, and I thought actually this is the space to ask. I keep wondering why there are no facilities at Greenbelt, as far as I can tell, for women and girls who are bleeding, who are on their period. Am I missing something? Because I haven't noticed any I haven't noticed anything being said or written. There are no notices in any toilets. There are nothing. I'm bleeding today. I know there will be hundreds and hundreds of others who are. And both on a practical level, but also what is the meaning of that in spaces like Greenbelt, where this is not... Is it being thought about? And if it has, then why haven't I heard about that?
Hi, thanks. And this is sort of piggybacking off of the last two. But so much of this festival is focused on what churches and other faith organizations can do to promote social justice and be part of change in a real way. And I've loved how this session has really responded to individual need and sort of communal need, but maybe not so much to social need. And maybe this could be an entrance point, because menopause is something that's shared, and yet gender is one of the most disadvantaged health points in sort of, you know, women are the most overlooked population for medical testing and things like that. And then that is exacerbated by other intersections of our identities. And I'm wondering where we could go from here in terms of women's health and social justice in this country, and the actually very difficult HRT access for many, many people.
There's definitely period poverty and social justice issues in as part of that. I agree. I think it's probably something that absolutely needs to be amplified in our discourse. And just even talking about period poverty for young women and girls in this country, let alone in other countries, is a real thing. So thank you for your point. I think that's probably all we have time for. So Greenbelt, please put your very warm hands together to thank Jane.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.